Okay, I think it's on. Beautiful. Okay. Everybody on the left-hand side can see the slides, yes or no?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. Over there last week, I felt like I was talking to another zip code over here this week. So I can't do it again. So hopefully we can see. David, you're going to be a little impaired there, but you got x-ray vision anyway, right?
I do. You I do. Need to see
it. Okay. Well, good morning, everyone. And everybody responds with one voice, good morning, teacher. It's good to see everybody. Good to see some faces that have been traveling around the world. Vern and Pete, nice to have you guys back. Or as you're better known, hey, you.
You got it, brother.
You got it. Hey, you. Okay, well, that's good. Well, what can we take before the Lord today as we get started? Prayer requests, praise requests. How come I always see, I'm going to see nothing but tops of the heads when this comes up? Okay, nothing? All right, let's open up in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for this time, and as I pray every week, Father, I just thank you for the privilege we have in this country, for the opportunity to open up your word. Thank you that you have given us your word that we can open up. Father, you are a God who communicates, and we're delighted always to have the opportunity to delve into what you have to say to us. I pray that you would bring your scriptures to life for us this morning as we look at this amazing sacrifice this morning that is called for from Abraham in this pinnacle of his faith and testing. And Father, may we understand this chapter in terms of the lessons that it can inform for us, and how you may test us in our lives and how you may discipline us in our lives. And yet, can we have the same kind of response that Abraham does, to trust in you in all things, and trust that you know how to work things out, and to just move forward in obedience and faith in the process. We pray for our country, Father, as we go through a rather fractious time and difficulty in affirming a Supreme Court justice, and just pray, Father, that we would be reminded of what this country was founded on. In God we trust. It's right on the money. And Father, we just pray that we might see a sense of revival in this country, or we'd remember the values that we came together as a nation, and that we can all learn how to communicate and deal with things in a civil process. Most of all, Father, may we be salt and light of that in the church, and may we show the world that the church is different, and may it be evident in our love for one another. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, well, we come to chapter 22 this week, and as I phrased it, the mother of all tests, one of my fact checkers in the North Campus reminded me that this was not the mother of all tests, but the father of all tests, so we can go through that, but indeed, this is idiomatically the mother of all tests, right? So what I want to do is just kind of spend a second here to set the stage as we enter into taking a look at what happens here. So from the very first, right, when we began this journey with Abraham back in chapter 12, God has promised to make Abraham a great nation, right? Abraham's going to make a great nation. And then over the ensuing years, the promise was repeated and enlarged. So more than what? The stars in the heavens. So rather hyperbolic way of representing that he will have many, many offsprings. Now, God also promised that he would have a specific descendant. So recall that we talked about that in terms of not only descendants in a plural sense, but descendant in a particular sense, and that, of course, will be the Messiah at some point in time, or that messianic line, and that they would come from Abraham, and that one would come from Abraham and Sarai. And yet over the ensuing years, if anything, the family is what? Shrinking, right? Lot's out. Ishmael's out, right? And yet, where's the kid? Okay, well, God, of course, is going to come through with his promises. Another 30 years pass. Abraham, even undergoing what he may have thought was a rather fanciful name change, right? He went from father of nations to father of a great multitude, right? So just imagine if you're Abraham, right? You're sitting there with no kids, and you're like, doesn't look like a horde to me. But indeed, we know that the long last one is born. And as we saw last week in chapter 21, those first few verses, there was just joy and rejoicing and laughter and over the joy of this child being born to them. Now, as we start this chapter 22, which is at least 15 years later, or I think more than likely as many as 35 years later, and we determine that by two date markers in the text. One is the death of Sarah, which we get in chapter 23. She's 127 years old. And she was what? How old at his birth? 90. Okay, back in 17 somewhere, I think. We got that. So we know that he's older. And we kind of have to presume that there's kind of continuous action here between these chapters, okay? The point is, and I won't arm wrestle anybody on this topic, he's, you know, grown into a man, even if he's 15, 16 years old, and as much as 35, which would probably be borne out because we see the next thing that happens is a wife for him in chapter 23. Now, life was good, right? They had clearly grown to love this child and care for this child. And life finally seems to be proceeding as God had promised, right? He's in the land. Everything's good. He's got peace. He's a prominent individual. He's got the seed. And then, boom, Abraham's peaceful world is shattered as we move into chapter 22. So, what's going on in this chapter? What's going on? Why do we see this event in this chapter? It's a test, that's for sure. And what's the test? Why a test? He's had plenty of them, right? You know, why not just move into chapter 23? It makes sense, you know, it's wind down time. You know, get the kid a wife, Sarah dies, get her a place to be buried, right? Why this test?
I'd say possibly because Abraham still hasn't learned that God is the provider and that he will provide.
Yeah, okay. So I think it's kind of first and foremost that this is kind of the climax of Abraham's faith, right? So we've seen this faith journey with Abraham, right? Sometimes he's performed very well. Other times he's kind of fallen down. So we're kind of coming to the pinnacle of all tests, and certainly this is a rather striking test. Hereafter, it's going to be a wind down in chapters 23 to the first part of 25 in terms of his transition to the next generation. God sets out, I think, here to affirm one last time Abraham's loyalties, and he does so in pretty dramatic fashion, right? So Abraham faces this supreme test and what must have been some very perplexing questions, right? So it's not only the test, but it really should have raised a lot of questions in his mind, yet we're going to see that he's going to yield to God's will, and he's going to be blessed abundantly in the process. So, in the chapter, what we're going to see is two men trusting their respective fathers. We're going to see, of course, Isaac protecting his, trusting his father, Abraham, and we're going to see Abraham trusting his heavenly father, God, in the process. And as an interesting side note, you know, the whole account of Isaac is going to go pretty quick once we hit 25, just a couple chapters on his life. So I think we may learn as much about Isaac in this chapter as we will in his actual subsequent life when we come to those chapters in just a minute. So, you've gotten used to this, right? It has to be alliterated, right? You know, you get out the old thesauruses there and find the T words this week. Okay, so we start with the test in verses 1 and 2. They're going to be a building tension in verses 3 to 7, at least there is for me. Then we're going to see Abraham's trust in verses 8 to 14. We're going to see, I've just called it a treaty, couldn't come up with a better T word there, but we're going to kind of see a reaffirmation of covenant blessings or an additional treaty that God makes with Abraham. And then finally, the last few verses of the chapter are the transition or making way for the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. Okay, so somebody read verses 1 and 2 for me, please. Danae. Where are you, Danae? Verses 1 and 2.
Now I hear about after these things where God tempted Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a
Okay, thank you. All right, so we start here with the test. Thankfully, we are informed as the readers right up front, this is a test, right? But who doesn't know it's a test?
Abraham,
okay, which is typical. So as in other places, he's in the dark. He's going to just have the test. This is the first time, by the way, that we do see this word in the Bible, test, right? And we should be reminded that there is a difference, right, between testing and temptation. Okay, testing and temptation. God introduces tests into the circumstances of our life to either refine our faith or to discipline us, but God does not do what? That's right. He doesn't tempt us, right? And why doesn't he tempt us? Right. Yeah, all you got to do is read the slide. That's right. Okay. I mean, it's inconsistent with his character, right? What is God? He's holy. What does holy mean? Amongst many other things, it means he's completely separate and can have nothing to do with what?
Sin.
Absolutely right. So it would be inconsistent for God to tempt someone to sin. But we do have many, many instances in the Bible where we see that God does test our faith or uses tests to get our attention and perhaps discipline us about things in our lives. Now, God speaks to Abraham, and he starts out by giving him three commands. What are the three commands he gives him?
The burnt offering.
Right? That's one.
Take your son.
What's that?
Take your son.
Right, right. Take, right. Offer. What's the other one?
Go.
Right? These are actually three commands in the Hebrew. Take him, go, and offer him. Okay? No confusion. Not a negotiation, not suggestions, do it. Now, what is the sacrifice that God calls for? What time? A burnt offering. Means what?
Something has to be burnt.
That means there's going to be some toast, right? Okay, it's a burnt offering. No confusion, right? And who is to be sacrificed or what?
Isaac,
right? But not just Isaac, his son. His only son, whom he loved, Isaac. Now, it almost seems like God's being a little cruel, right? I mean, it's bad enough. Yeah, bad enough to the sacrifice, but let me just dig it in a little bit. That one, the only one, the one you've really come to love, that's the one I want you to sacrifice. So what is he doing by that? I mean, obviously God's not being cruel. So what are we seeing by that kind of progression of description?
Loyalty.
What's that?
He wants loyalty.
Yeah, he wants loyalty. That's for absolute sure. And he's using that description to heighten the stakes about the choice that he wants Abraham to make, right? And as Kitty rightly says, it's going to be loyalty or faithfulness or obedience, okay, under the harshest of circumstances. Now, what is the choice? What's the choice?
Do it or don't do it.
Yeah, but even more than that, the choice between what and what?
Obedience
and disobedience. Personalize it.
Faith and unbelief.
Faith and unbelief. Come on, easier one. Priority of Abraham's affections.
God
or the kid. Okay, Abraham, you need to show me what or whom you love more. Now, we shouldn't be surprised about tests, right? We've been seeing it all along. But I think we can all agree this one is particularly striking, is it not? I mean, that's a hard choice, right? I know we have parents out there. Could you imagine God asking you to do this? Yeah?
Well, not only that.
You're not going to tell me he did.
No.
Caleb, run.
No.
Yeah, get out of here.
Not only that, but you know what? I've never looked at this from the age factor.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm not going to be able to wrestle my son at an advanced age as Abraham is with Isaac. So, you know, God had a purpose in it all, but I just never looked at the age factor. But Isaac was willing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I never looked at it from that angle.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. That's an important, important point.
I've heard some bad exposition of this passage.
Okay.
Do you think, too, I mean, to me, what's blindingly evident is for him to say, your only son,
right,
is pretty declarative in terms of who the chosen line is.
Uh-huh.
Because he's got two sons.
Right.
Now, one is out of the picture.
Right.
But it doesn't change the fact that he has two sons.
That's right.
So when God says, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love.
Yeah.
But he's the only son of the seed that God recognizes.
Well, and I think that's the point that Ken's making.
Yes.
Yeah, which is exactly right.
Which is really like, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. No, in fact, that's even a better articulation of what I said there. I mean, it's not only the point of who it is, but it's the seed line that he's selling, telling him to sacrifice. Okay? So there's a lot of parallels and foreshadowing in here we're going to see. And I think Ken rightly notes that, yeah, it's not only... You know, he did have another son. He could try to pull in a substitute, but no, he wants him to sacrifice the one that's going to be the line. Yes, Danae.
The part of this test is striking. He's striking his only loved son, who he only loves.
That's right.
As Ken said, the one that's out of the picture is Ishmael.
Yeah.
But that does not change the fact that he has two sons whom he loves.
Yeah. That's right. He does have two that he loves. You're absolutely right. No doubt about that. But, yep, as he says, it's a particular one that they're pointing to. Okay. So, God's going to test him. Not surprising, but the magnitude is striking. So, the site for the testing is the land of Moriah. Okay. The land of Moriah, that's used proleptically. That's a fancy seminary term for meaning it's used prophetically. Moriah doesn't exist at this time, but because it's, you know, a heavenly speaker, they know what's coming, okay? So it's Moriah, means he's identifying a place there. Does anybody know the significance of this site in terms of where it is?
Jerusalem.
What's that?
Mount Zion.
Yeah, so Jerusalem, but even more particularly within that, it's the Temple Mount, okay? And we have this confirmed in 2 Chronicles 3 in chapter 1. And it's also likely where David made his offering to end the plague, okay? And if you remember the account, the owner of that piece of land offered to give it to David, right? And what did David say?
I want to buy it.
Yeah, I want to buy it because?
I don't want to offer anything to God without sacrifice.
Without it costing me something, right? Sacrificing, exactly right. And obviously we're going to see that Abraham is being called to make a pretty costly sacrifice in the process. So I just love kind of the way these things all connect together. Okay? So somebody read verses 3-7 for me.
Early the next morning, Abraham got up and saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father?" "Yes, my son," Abraham replied. "The fire and wood are here," Isaac said, "but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?"
Okay, so now we kind of move into this process, and we're really seeing tension begin to build in the story. Now remember, I've said, the Bible has a lot of emotion in it, right? So you need to try to put yourself in Abraham's shoes, right? This tension is building. Now, what is notable about Abraham's response?
"We'll both come back."
Yeah, well, you're kind of jumping ahead there. Right here in verse 3, you're absolutely right. Hold your horses.
He did not delay. He obeyed immediately.
Okay, that's one aspect. He immediately obeys, which we see has been Abraham's pattern. But what else is kind of interesting about his response? What?
He didn't come to his wife.
Oh, you're still hanging out on that last week's thing, huh? Apparently I'm getting a lesson myself this morning. Oh, yeah. No, I don't think that's it. But it was a nice try.
So he could go hiding away and not get sacrificed.
Look, here's the other thing. He didn't say anything.
No. Mm-hmm.
He didn't say anything. Right? So look, in Genesis 18, he went and interceded in a rather significant way for a bunch of people he didn't know. Lot he does know, of course, but a whole bunch of people he doesn't know. And here God says, sacrifice your son, your only son, the one you love, and he doesn't say a peep? Okay, well, what do you think is going on? I mean, why doesn't he say anything? Yeah, okay, I think that's the conclusion, okay? I think that is the conclusion. Clearly, he's trusting God. But what do you think's going on in his head right now?
He's wanting to sacrifice his own son. That's why he put the wood on his son and carried the fire and knife.
Yeah, he is willing to do that. Yep, we're going to see that, right? So what else? What is it? What is going on?
I suppose that he's thinking, I don't understand how this is going to work out, but God is sovereign.
I suppose that's exactly what he's thinking.
God's got a plan.
Right? Yeah, I think that's exactly right. At minimum,
we remind ourselves of that today?
Yeah, of course.
I don't know how this is all going to work out. But
yeah. Well, that's God's the implication, sovereign. Right? I mean, it's right. I mean, this is not a long-term plan either, right? This is only a couple days away. Moriah was about 45 miles. It was probably, as we learned from the text, it was a three-day journey. So it's not like he could go around in circles and kind of drag this thing out for a while. But the fact of the matter is, we don't know what tomorrow holds, right? So I think it is a good point. So at a minimum, we see his faith, right? And his responsibility is obedience, okay? So Abraham ultimately always understands what the expected response is, right? But I think there is something more at this point, and that's what it is. I think in his silence, he is trying to reconcile what God's request means with what God had previously told him. Okay, he's trying to work this out in his head. Today we might call it discernment. All right, so as Betty already said, I mean, it's a good way to respond when we're facing various different things in our life, right? When something comes into your life, if we believe in God's providence, it's probably not what? Circumstantial. It's probably there because God intended it to be there. So a really good way to respond is to not start running our gums. And how do we usually respond? Go ahead and show me the faces.
Grumble.
Whiny, 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 whiny. Grumble's good. If we ever get to the book of Numbers, we can talk about the grumbling of the wilderness wandering. But at this pace, many of us may be knowing exactly what the book says, enjoying our glorified bodies. But nevertheless, with that wonderful thought in our heads, we think about discernment, okay? So I think Abraham is exercising discernment right here. He's trying to work through in his head what's going on. So
logically, and I know logic doesn't always prevail, but
right?
What would a father say to his son? You know, he said what he said, and
right.
He's not going to argue the point with his son.
Right. Well, what does he, answer your own question, what does he say to his son?
God will provide.
Yeah. That's what he said.
Yeah.
That takes a lot of faith, so he's either dodging the question, right, or he's got good faith. So we're going to get to that. Good question, okay? Now, let's see if we can kind of reason through it, right? What is the tension that God's demand poses? What's the tension? What is he's trying to work out in his head, do you think? Exactly correct, right? How can God promise one thing and then command me to do something that completely contradicts the promise, right? So in other words, there is a conflict between God's promise in Aaron's descendants through this particular seed and God's command to sacrifice this particular seed, okay? So that's the conflict, all right? How can God do this? Now, presented with this conflict, what are the possible solutions? What possible solutions could he have come up with? Yeah, you're taking a big leap of faith there, but not a terrible one. We'll get to that. Yeah,
there
that's
could
fair.
Be another son coming. I mean, he could sacrifice Isaac, and God could provide another son.
Yeah, it's possible. Well, maybe he's got another one coming. Yeah. Again, remember,
but you said at this point that Sarah had passed away.
No. I'm sorry. In 23, she dies. Okay, so she's still there. I was jumping ahead to do the date marker. Yeah, that'd be a little hard. That'd be really interesting. That'd be more than a dead womb. Okay. So maybe he thought that there would be another child. Okay. Probably doesn't. What else might he be thinking?
Well,
Bobby.
That he provided on the sacrifice.
Ah, okay, yeah. They might provide an alternative and things like that. Okay, so, you know, assume.
Or that he may stop him before he starts.
What's that?
Or that God may intervene before.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, if you look at Abraham's obedience, you would see that he fully expected to carry it out and probably fully expected God would do something else. Now, he could have, you know, thought that there would be a substitute or something else. But so we assume that he could assume that God was confused, right? Right? So how do we go with that answer with our little bobbleheads? No, right? You're probably not confused. Or assume that God will somehow reconcile the conflict, and then what?
Do it.
Just do it. Nike. Okay, they had Nikes back then. All right, so which is what Abraham does, right? Verse 3 says that he sets out early the next day to fulfill God's command. Yet I don't think he stopped trying to reconcile his intentions just yet. Okay, I think he's still thinking about it. So what other thoughts do you think might have come to mind? How do you think he might have reasoned, continued reasoning through the process?
I know this is early in Genesis, but could he have thought that God being so powerful could raise him from the dead?
Sure, I think that's very valid. I think that's very valid. He could have thought that. I mean, raised up a child from a dead womb, right? He's seen God do a lot of miracles, okay. So maybe first he kind of reviewed some history, okay? He's probably a thoughtful guy. You know, God's told me to do things before and made promises before, and what? They've always worked out, right? Okay, so that's kind of one thing. So I know who God is, right? God made it clear that Isaac's my seed, and I don't think God's confused, right? And that my descendants would come through him. So I think one of the great starting points that we should always have when we're thinking through challenges before us is ask ourselves, who is God? And what do we believe about him? Okay, what do we believe about God? Okay, so Abraham, I think, is kind of reasoning through this. Now, then maybe he thought about some of the things he'd learned, right? He learned some stuff through Hagar, right? She had a pretty wild experience the first time in the wilderness. What happened? Took the kid out there. God comes up with some water. An angel of the Lord comes and talks to her. She comes back with a name for the child. Right? Abraham obviously believes this, right? Because he does indeed name the child Ishmael. Okay, so he's seen God at work before. He's seen God at work in his own encounters with men, right? He's gone down to Egypt once. He's gone into Gerar once. He's pulled his lame move, right? Yep. Hey, it's my sister. Good looking sister, don't you think? Right? Okay. And God, every time, has preserved her in this process, has given him greater provisions as he moved out of it, okay? And then he's seen God's provision and protection in general for all the time he's been in his land. So, okay, I know who God is. I've seen how God works, right? So then he kind of moves on to some conclusions, right? And so I think we've all gotten the conclusion. So starting with, God's trustworthy and he doesn't lie. Okay, so we can trust God. That's our starting point. So maybe he has a plan, planning some kind of miracle, right? Because, gosh, the child himself was a miracle. And it dawns on him at that point, whoa, maybe he's going to resurrect him. Okay, so we do have some legitimate sense that he may have felt that he could bring the person back to life. Yeah, that's it. He's going to resurrect Isaac after I kill him. Now, I still think it'd be pretty darn hard to carry out what he was asked to do, right? I mean, I don't care what you thought about what might happen. Just the process of doing it, right? I have a hard time killing a little bird or something, you know, much less that. Okay, so now I'm speculating, but I think it's at least sanctified speculation with some textual support. So where might we get some support for this idea of Abraham believing that the child might be resurrected? Do we have any support for that? What's that? What do you have there?
God is in his spirit, he believes.
Yeah, okay. Anything more specific than Romans 4? That's a general one. I agree. That's a good one. Okay, Audrey, yeah?
Hebrews.
Yeah? Whereabouts? You can just give me a chapter. All right. All right. Well, that's...
Right in here,
11, well, yeah, okay. So We're going to...
God will provide the land.
Yeah, we're going to see it here in the near context, but let's just jump ahead to Hebrews 11, okay? So go to Hebrews 11, and let's look at verses 17 to 19. Hebrews 11, 17 to 19. So this is this great hall of faith, right? All these saints that went before us. In 17 it says, "By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up," what? "His only begotten son." Interesting language there. "It was he to whom it was said," meaning Abraham, "in Isaac your descendants shall be called." And now this verse 19. "He considered," this is Abraham, "that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type." Now, type's an unfortunate translation here, okay? Because this is not a type. We'll get to that in a second. The actual word is in parable, okay? Or parabolically, or figuratively speaking is a better translation. Okay, so figuratively speaking, he can indeed raise people from the dead. So I'm not sure that Abraham was fully convinced this would happen, but what he is acknowledging that God is able to do this. Okay, so we see again the trust in the process. All right, so back to Genesis 22. And as I said, I think we've got some support for it in Hebrews. Now, so whether this is right or wrong, we can conclude that Abraham had confidence in God. Okay, no question he had confidence in God. So back to our storyline, Abraham assembles the resources and the helpers for the trip, and he himself cuts the wood. Now, he wouldn't normally do this, I expect, so maybe he's buying a little time, kind of getting used to the idea. And then on the third day of the journey, he sees the destination of in the distance, and he and the lad set off on the final leg. Now, what's interesting about verse 5? What's interesting about verse 5?
He doesn't want the servants to
go. Yeah, doesn't want the servants to go. Yeah, that's one thing. I can see why that would be the case.
We will come back.
So what's it say there at the end of verse 5? It says, "Hey, Abraham said to the young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and I will come back?"
No, we will come back.
Okay? So, we shall go, we shall return. In the actual Hebrew, this is very emphatically stated. Okay? So it's using a form called the cohortative, which is a strong exhortation or a command. So it's like he's saying, we're going and we're coming back. Okay? So he's just stating it very assertively in the Hebrew. Okay, so who does the we refer to, of course, Abraham and Isaac. Okay, so we are both going to come back. So I also have some near textual evidence for my sanctified speculation. Abraham clearly believes that he's coming back with the kid. Okay, now, I don't think he's got it worked out how it's going to happen, but he believes, right? I mean, that is some strong, strong belief in the process. Okay, so they set out, take the materials, sets them on the, they set out for the mountain, and then Abraham gets the question that I'm sure he's been dreading from the moment they started, right? What is the question? Right, and we're in the Steve Smith version. Hey, Pop, where is the lamb, right? And what does Abraham say? Well, let's read verses 8 to 14.
"And Abraham said, my son God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering. So the two of them went together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him. And Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood in order. And he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. So he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Then Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by its thorns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place, the Lord will provide. as it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord, it shall be provided.
Okay, so now we start to see the trust that Abraham demonstrates, right? Which reads us to the rest of the narrative in 8 to 14. Okay, we see his amazing trust. Now my clicker is stopping the clicking. Okay, now, does Abraham dodge the question? No, I don't think so. He doesn't, I do believe he fully trusted that God would provide some kind of substitute. Now, I think he showed good parenting, right? He didn't kind of lay out the whole plan, but I don't think Isaac was completely oblivious at this point in time, and I think we get to an interesting point, which Dave mentioned earlier, and that is the age and the strength of the child, okay? So we're going to see some stuff about him in the process.
Yeah. Know anything about, you know, whether human sacrifice is a common thing in that era?
Not necessarily in that era, but we're going to see later on, right? Molech, is it Molech? Sacrificing to Molech? And
yeah. Funny, I told you I heard a bad exposition this passage. This past year we were up in New Jersey and went to an old church that I went to. Worst exposition this passage I ever thought. He based it on the Molechs and then just went off on a tangent, this guy did.
Wow.
Totally out of left field.
Yeah.
I'd love to send him a recording of this.
Yeah, so I'm not sure it was. I'd have to do a little more research and see if it had been there at all. Yeah, Roger?
Throughout so far in the Bible, we're not seeing God bringing anybody back to life.
Right.
So the thought of Abraham thinking that he's going to kill his son and God's going to revive it, it's very possible that God would have done that.
Right.
But there's no evidence.
No precedent.
Before
yeah.
this.
Nope. Nope.
So yeah. I think the substitution is more of a.
Okay. Well, hold that thought, you man of jumping ahead. Very good. Yeah.
I'd like to read verse 8 in the King James.
Yeah.
It says, "And Abraham said, my son, God will provide himself."
Yeah.
"A lamb,"
right,
"for a burnt offering."
Yeah.
So they both went together.
All right. That's a bad translation. I got the question this morning. And the reason is, in the Hebrew, there's a very specific preposition. It says for, okay? For himself. Okay, so it's a wonderful if it was that way, because we would absolutely have a clear early doctrine of substitutionary atonement. But I went back and looked this morning before I left because somebody asked the same question. The specific preposition for is right in front of the word himself. So he provided the sacrifice. He will provide a sacrifice for himself, okay? So it's not himself, meaning God, that is the substitute here. And so that's, it's an artifact of the King James. We see that sometimes. There'll be another example in the New Testament on Wednesday night from going through 1 John, and in chapter 5, we see kind of the Trinity on display, and there's a scribal emendation that says Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in an attempt to give us a very clear passage on the Trinity, but it's not part of the earlier manuscript. So it's an interpretive decision on the part of the translators of the New King James. They also are working with different manuscripts. There's different manuscripts that some of these versions are being translated from, and there's a whole science behind here called textual criticism when they try to figure it out. Now, it's not as big a deal in the Old Testament because we have less manuscripts. The problem in the New Testament is we have tons of manuscripts, in excess of almost 6,000. So they're trying to reconcile what the original text was. So while it says that, I don't think we can, if I look at the Hebrew, I would say it's not. We shouldn't draw that substitution. Now, we will get it. We'll get this idea of substitution in just a minute. But it's not God saying, I'm the substitute. Okay, it's just he will provide the substitute. Okay, now I do think it's fair to say that as we have the New Testament, we learn more about that, right? But at this point, and if we're being faithful to the Hebrew, then I would say that I couldn't go that far with the text at this point. Okay, all right, good question, good observation, and I had that question this morning. All right, so I forgot where we were now. Okay, does he dodge the question? No. As it turns out, he is going to be somewhat prophetic, though, in his response, right? Now, what is notable about Isaac's response? What's notable about his response? To the. What's that? Absolutely. There ain't one. No protest, right? Which means what?
He has strong faith.
He believes his father. Right? Now, I guess that shouldn't be real surprising, right? Because I'm sure if he is in fact as much as 35, that his father's been teaching him all this time, right? So we shouldn't be surprised. Even at 15, he would have been teaching him all this time, okay? So, you know, I think it's probably a good reflection on Abraham and what he'd been teaching him about God. Because Abraham doesn't say, hey, I'll come up with a plan B, son. Don't sweat it. Right? What does he say? No, God will provide for himself the sacrifice. Okay? So Abraham or Isaac hears that, says, yeah, my dad's been telling me all about this guy, and you know, he's pretty faithful, so okay, I'm good with that, right? And then which continues by allowing his father to bind him, right? I mean, come on. Right? I used to run for the belt. Not much less the getting tied up and thrown in the fireplace. Right? So think about it for a minute. I mean, he willingly allows his father to do this and lay him on the wood. Okay? I mean, man.
He raises the knife.
Yeah. I'd have been sweating some serious bullets and running. Okay, so by this time, Isaac clearly knows that he's the planned sacrifice at this point in time. So what is amazing about Isaac's character? He willingly submits to his father's will. Right, he could surely have overpowered him, but he seems to have a faith that rivals Abraham. Right, so as we think about Isaac, and we're not going to hear much about him when we get to him. It's just two quick chapters. I think you just have to. It's almost like he's a bridge. You know, let's get to Jacob. You know, the story's going to get interesting then again. But you know, he obviously has a very strong faith. Okay, so all's made ready. Abraham is ready to go. Right. Whew. At which point, what? The angel of the Lord calls out and reveals God's true intentions to Abraham. All right? So, now, what is it that God is satisfied with?
Abraham's heart and willingness.
Yeah. Right, right. Expressed as what? Fear for God, okay? Which we know is not a fear of punishment per se, although there is punishment and we should have some fear. But it's the idea of awe and reverence for who God is, okay? So God sees that and affirms it. But do you think God didn't really know?
No.
Right. So really, what would have been the purpose? Well, I think the purpose is really maybe more for Abraham and Isaac.
Isaac's growth.
Right? So we see the idea that, you know, again, Abraham is having kind of reaffirmed in the pinnacle opportunity that, hey, God does provide, right? And Isaac is seeing it firsthand, right? Where he's the recipient, right? Up till now, it's all been pops, right? Now it's him in terms of the whole process. So, you know, God's kind of beginning to teach Isaac in a more direct way, and then we'll see him reaffirm all the covenant promises and so forth and so on as we get into 25 to 27.
But so, isn't that the point of all the tests that God puts us through?
Absolutely. Absolutely. To affirm who he is and to remind us that we have weak faith, which we kind of got to last week, right? But I'm sorry, did you, Carl?
Well, I was just going to say that God is also not only teaching Abraham and Isaac, but us also.
Yeah.
And it's his word for us.
Right. Absolutely. Right. You know, and again, you know, Mark talked about weak faith a couple weeks ago. Yeah. Jack.
There's another part of you refer to Isaac's compliance. I don't think they carried the wood themselves for 3 days.
Right.
Probably had it on a donkey.
Right.
All of a sudden, you take the wood and give it to Isaac and say, "You carry this."
Yeah. You carry up the fuel.
Put it on the horse.
Yeah.
Let him carry it.
Exactly right. So another affirmation of what?
Obedience.
Yeah. Isaac could have clearly, at a minimum, he could have outrun the old guy, right? So, and not overpower him. So, yeah, I think you see all those little pieces. And that's what's great about the Bible, right? You just see these little pieces of evidence. And you look at it and say, okay, so he carried the wood. What's the big deal? Well, it's everything's affirming something. I think Jack makes a good point. It's affirming what Isaac could have done, right, in terms of his ability and his strength and where he was. So we see the whole process there. Okay, so he had predicted. Now, what else is interesting about, well, first of all, we see that as Abraham had kind of predicted, God did indeed provide a sacrifice, right? He looks up, there's a ram stuck in the thorns, or struck by his horns, whatever. So what is interesting about verse 13? Well, God's perfect timing is one, right? Yeah, so I think that's a good implication, right? So God shows up on time, at the right time, right? Never too early, never too late. What else?
He didn't see it until after the test was complete.
Right.
You know, he didn't walk, I mean, you would think that if there was a ram stuck in the thorns, he'd be making noises and...
If I was about to kill my kid, I'd be telling you my head would be on a 360, that's for sure. Yeah, so that's a good point. So, yeah, so it probably miraculously showed up, right? So, again, another miracle. But what else? Look at the end of the verse. What?
He will provide.
Yeah, but look at the end of the verse. What's it say?
He did offer a burnt offering.
He did. Look at the end of the verse 13. What does it say? In place of. Instead of the son. Okay? So, look at the phrase, what doctrine do we begin to see from this?
Substitution,
right? So you guys were way ahead of the game. You had it figured out in your heads, but we just had to build and see it in the text, okay? He clearly is showing substitution, right? In place of, right? In place of. It's very specific in the Hebrew, okay? To say that he provided an alternative, a substitution, or a substitutionary atonement. Now, as I've been saying, as we've been traversing through these chapters of Genesis, all of the fundamental doctrines of our faith are laid out in these early chapters. Skeletal forms, right? But it's there. So it's, to me, proof positive of the progressive nature of revelation in the Bible, and we get these cornerstones very early. Right? So we get them if we're listening and paying attention. And of course, as we have the benefit of the New Testament, we get the affirmations and the fulfillment of many of them. Okay, so substitution. Abraham memorializes the place with a site name, Yahweh Yireh, which everybody always says Jehovah Jireh, okay, meaning the Lord will provide. Okay, so another name for God. Remember, we looked at that a while back. God reveals himself in his names. We learn about his character. All right, this, verses 15 to 19.
Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares of the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son. Indeed, I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young man, and they arose and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham lived at Beersheba.
Okay, thank you, Danae. Now, we go into this final part, which I'm calling the treaty, right? So God speaks again to Abraham in the aftermath of the sacrifice. And what is interesting about verse 16? What's going on there? Just pick out the obvious.
He reconfirms his faith.
Yeah, not so much the faith, but what he does is he adds a unilateral oath, okay, to confirm that Abraham will receive covenant blessings. Okay, let me be clear about that. It was not any contingency to the covenant itself. The covenant is not conditioned upon obedience. But we've seen several times leading up to here that the degree to which God was going to bless him was tied to the degree of his obedience, right? And we can see this same parallel in our lives today, right? If you're running around in disobedience, do not be expecting God to give you the kiss of faith, but maybe the slap of obedience, right? So the fact of the matter is, as we see his obedience, God is now reaffirming covenant blessings to him in this process. Now, how do you see that reconfirmed in the text in the first part of verse 17? How do you see that?
It says, I will surely bless you.
Right.
It didn't say if then.
Yeah, didn't say right. Yeah, he says, I will surely. So we see the unilateral nature, and we also see the kind of the excessiveness. So either the word surely, or you may see the word greatly in your text, right? It's not that I'll bless you. I will surely bless you. Okay, so emphasis, or I will greatly bless you, right? And in fact, we see this twofold repetition of that word, right? Now, it's interesting. In the Hebrew, they don't have this good, better, best. So the way they say that is by repeating the verbs, okay? And so what it really says, and I think New King James may have it. What does your King James say? Read me verse...
Which verse?
17, the second, the first part of it.
It says, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed
okay.
as the stars.
Yeah, okay. So see how she said that? That's literally what the Hebrew says. Okay, so to bless I will bless, and to multiply I will multiply. Okay, and that's how we then, you know, it's idiomatic, okay? So it's fine to take it over as surely or greatly. But the fact is that he's emphasizing the degree or the excess to which he's going to bless him in this process. So again, remember, every time we see what looks like something that is kind of changing the terms of the covenant, you've got to remember that a covenant once ratified, what? Never
changes.
Okay? So what we're seeing is something more about the blessings and the process.
Stephen,
yeah.
In verse 16 again, and he repeats the fact, and you've said this before, when they repeat it, it means it's emphasized even more that you have not only withheld your son, your only son.
Yeah, exactly right.
It's that phrase again.
Exactly. So, you know, this is typical of Hebrew narrative. You see a lot of repetition, okay? And again, it's part of it's because it's an oral tradition, but part of it is also, as you note, for emphasis, okay? So, yeah, you didn't withhold the particular one I wanted you to withhold, so here we go to the next step. Now, a new metaphor, right, to describe the number of descendants. So we had the stars of the heavens before. Now we have the sands of the sea, right?
Mm-hmm.
We probably haven't been to the sea too much with that stinky red tide. But the fact of the matter is, next time you go, just try to get all the sand of the sea off your toes when you're getting back in the car, right? We know there is a lot of this. So his descendants now are also, an interesting thing here, going to possess the gates of their enemies. Okay, so we know that he's going to get the land. So this is an emphasis on the ruling also in the land. So the gate, right, that was kind of the seat of the government, if you will. That's where all the deals were struck. That's where the quote-unquote elders hung out. And so if you're possessing the gate, that is a way of saying that you are ruling not only in the land, you're not only in the land, but you're ruling in the land. Okay, now, but there is actually something much more significant about the blessing when we get into the second part of verse 17 and the first part of 18. So what's going on there? So
it's extended to all the nations.
Yeah, and something.
The blessing is spread to other nations.
Yeah, you both have said that. And this is where the text, the English translations are going to trap you. Okay.
Through the seed.
Exactly. Did you say seed or did you say seeds?
Seed.
Ah.
Seed.
Through the seed, no S. Okay. Right? So basically, these next two parts, 17b and verse 18a, have messianic implications. Okay? We put these two things together. Now, note I'm saying implications. It's not full on prophecy. Right? So 315. Full-on prophecy, right? We get to Genesis 49:10, I think it is. Judah, the tribe of Judah, full-on prophecy. Number other prophecies, right? But certainly messianic implications in this statement. And messianic implication from two perspectives. So let me kind of tell you how we arrive at this. So we come across this word again, right? Remember we've talked about this Hebrew word, zerah? It is a collective term, which means that it has only a singular form, but it can be translated singularly or plurally, okay? And your context has to be the guide in deciding how to do that. Now, in the first part of verse 17, I think seeds or descendants, plural, is justified, right? And why is it justified?
Because it says numerous.
Right. talking about the number of descendants in the process. So we're talking about, you know, a plurality. So that is the nations at that sense there. Now, in most of your English versions, in the middle of verse 17, there's either a semicolon or a period, right? So what it looked like in your versions? Now, this is a case where I think that's a good interpretive decision. The idea here is that there is a change in thought that is happening in the middle of verse 17, okay? Now, this is correct, and we see the new idea. Now, you could carry the plural idea over, okay? And the way that you know that the versions, English versions, are not sure is if they're faithful enough to put a footnote in there and give you a different marginal reading, okay? So many of them do, most of them. But you could carry the plural over, which both the King James, New King James, and the NIV do, and they say, descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. Okay, notice what I'm saying, descendants, plural, there. Or your descendant, one, shall possess the gate of their enemies, which is kind of an odd construction, putting a plural pronoun with a singular scenario. Anybody got an ESV out there? Read it, please.
And their seed shall possess the gate of his enemies.
His enemies, okay? Mixed witness. This is a small change with big implications, okay? So as I was looking through the English versions, I did go back and look at the Hebrew, and guess what? In the Hebrew, there is an absolutely clear third person masculine singular pronoun, okay? His, singular, enemies, okay? Now, quick grammar lesson, pronouns what? The pronoun stands in for a noun. It usually looks back, correct?
Right.
And it has to agree in number, singular or plural, and gender, masculine or singular, okay? So, singular or plural, male or female, masculine or feminine. And so for grammatical accord, we have to look back and see what the referent is. And it yields, and your seed, singular, shall possess the gate of his enemies, as in the final clause, okay? So we see that happen.
Okay, mine says your descendants will take possession of your cities and their enemies through your offspring.
Right.
So in the second part, it makes it very clear.
But why bother to make it confusing? Just go ahead and make it clear on the pronoun, because it's right there in the Hebrew.
Yeah.
All right, so, you know, I'm not picking on these guys. It's not easy to translate this stuff, okay? But this one is pretty clear in the actual text. And I think when you then marry it with that, okay, when you marry it with the first part of verse 18, we'll see that in a second. Now, there's also one other confirmation here, and that is in Hebrew verbs, you get person, number, and gender. Okay, so in a Hebrew verb, you could have a one-word sentence in Hebrew. The subject can be drawn out of the verb form, and it can have a direct object, appended to the word. Okay, so you know, Hebrew starts with three-letter roots, and then the words go like this. They put stuff on the front, they put stuff on the back, and you can have a whole sentence in a word. So you can pull the number and gender out of the verb. Again, verbs match their nouns, right, in number and gender. So the verb here, of course, is third person, masculine, singular. So we have a very clear-cut case, grammatically, that this is referring to a particular seed, okay? That seed is going to defeat or possess the gates of your enemies, right? So, proper translation, you think it is, and who's it referring to? Christ, okay? And it's probably alluding to Genesis 3:15, right? Because what do we get in Genesis 3:15? He's going to bruise you, he's going to crush you, okay? So he's going to conquer the work of the serpent, okay? So we see a very powerful thing at the end of verse 17. Now, it goes on, and I'm further convinced because of what happens in the first part of verse 18, right? So again, we get zerah, seed. We have to make the decision. We have all the same grammatical markers with the singular pronoun, right? Now, your is always hard, right? Because y'all got to be southern, do y'all, or your, and you got to figure out singular or plural. But in the actual text, the forms of the pronouns are very clear. So So it's the singular possessive, second person, okay? So your seed again, leading to translate the seed as singular. Now, what we then have is a reference to Abraham's singular seed. And what's this seed going to do? Previously, it's going to defeat and occupy the gates. What's it say it's going to do here? Bless the nations. Where do we hear that before? Way back in Genesis 12, right? So who do we have here again? Christ, okay? So we see a really powerful messianic reference or implication in these two verses if we're carefully translating the text, okay? I believe that a Hebrew speaker would have naturally gotten this, particularly one back then, because we're at such a distance and we're not natural Hebrew speakers. It's harder for us, right? But we do see a powerful thing. So, pretty nifty, eh? That's just to impress you with all my language skills. I can switch from Hebrew to Canadian like that.
The most important is the very last where it says, because you have obeyed me.
Right, right, yeah, and I like that. I should have emphasized that. The point is, the reason why God does all this, because of Abraham's obedience, right? So we see that. So both Abraham narrative and this final test converge in this messianic reference. And when you think about it, it makes perfect sense because all the events of Christ's sacrifice are really foreshadowed here. And note that I'm saying foreshadowed, not typifies. Remember, we talked about types before. One of the key things about a type is there has to be correspondence, okay? So it foreshadows, but it doesn't correspond, right? So first of all, substitutionary death idea, yes, correspondence there. But Isaac didn't actually die and resurrected, right? Okay, so not perfect correspondence. In Isaac's sacrifice, Abraham's love for God is being tested. In Christ's sacrifice, what? God's love for us is being demonstrated. That's a pretty big difference, okay? In God interceded in Isaac's sacrifice, he poured out his wrath in Christ's sacrifice. So it is fair to say that we see things foreshadowed here, and we can draw those conclusions. But this is not a type of Christ's death and resurrection in the New Testament. Okay, so I'm going to read the last part here so nobody has to deal with these names. 20 to 24, now it came to pass after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, behold, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor, Uz, his firstborn, and Buz, his drinking brother, right? And Kemuel, the father of Aram, and Chesed, and Hazo, and Pildash, and Jidlaf, and Bethuel. Bethuel became the father of Rebekah. These eight Milcah bore to Nahor, Abraham's brother. What's he emphasizing? Abraham's brother, family connection here. His concubine, whose name was Rumah, also bore Tabah, Gaham, Tahash, and Ma'akah. Okay, so what is the purpose of these final verses? What's that? Yeah, it's transition. What, Danae?
The family connection of those eight and the two parents.
Yeah.
Yep,
absolutely, the connection.
All the family all together.
Uh-huh, and it's pointing to what? Introducing an important character who's going to come up, right?
Rebecca.
Okay, so who is going to figure prominently as we go forward? So this is transition, and it's pointing to and getting us ready for what's going to happen next in chapter 23, which is what? Yeah, kid's old enough, it gets he needs a wife,
yep.
Right? Okay, so we're moving through the process. So show how God is going to provide a suitable wife with an emphasis on her lineage, okay? So here's your picture, right? And Rebecca's the one, whoops, there. So you get it, it's online, don't worry. You'll see him online. Not gonna get him. Okay, so I'm going to end with a couple of implications here because I think there's some really important ones. The first is this, we are most useful to God when our hands are empty, right? Because we're not grasping on to something, right? What are we? By nature, grabbers, right? So God's got to pry our hands open, put it forward, and say, okay, now I can use you in the process. Secondly, while obedience may result in material blessing, the real blessing is a deeper relationship with God, right? This is what we want more the material blessing. If he gives us material blessing, fine. But the fact of the matter is that spiritual blessing and relationship is our goal. seeing that Abraham was willing to give up his dearest possession to God, should remind us that God gave up for us what was most precious to him, right? His only begotten Son, who received our penalty for sin and paves the way for us to have a relationship. Our faith is refined in testing. The harder the test, the greater the refining. Okay, we see some of that. God may call you to demonstrate your faith with something costly. He might not, but he might. So don't be surprised if he does. And then the last one here, which I think is kind of the only kind of sacrificial parallel that we can draw out of this for that, and I would say it's this. Our closest sacrificial parallel is to die to self, right? So we can make a sacrifice, and we need to make a sacrifice as we're following Christ, and that sacrifice is to die to self. Okay, Joe, would you close us up in a word of prayer?
Lord, we're grateful that we can reflect on these truths, even these implications, and the importance of, as Jesus said, if you're going to come after me, you must die to self.